Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Coming up on today's program, terror attack, more terrorism. Terror attack strikes Manchester Arena over there in the UK. Latest developments on that. Also, President Trump is overestimating the Palestinians' desire for peace. That's a write-up from The Federalist. Grant will take a look at that for us. And also Instagram. I'm sure you've heard of that. Probably have it, maybe. They say it's the most harmful social network for your mental health. That and more this edition, Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. This is Trumpet Radio Live, the Tuesday edition. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here, Abraham Blondeau. He said he'll stop by, if you can trust that guy.
He might come around eventually if he feels like
he'll be around. He's got some other tasks he's taking care of, but he said he'll be around later, which I hope he is because he's got some good stories for us. And so lots going on. Last night I stopped by a graduation get-together, that time of the year where families are having some graduation celebrations, and somebody said, "Did you hear about the bombing?" I said, "No, I had not." And so they showed me the headlines, and of course that's what happened last night. At least 22 people have died and more than 100 injured after what Theresa May described as a, quote, appalling terror attack at the Manchester Arena during an Ariana Grande pop concert. And so to this point, 22 people have been killed, more than 100 injured, including 12 children. I think the youngest was 8 years old. So this was a very soft target, as they call it, and full of younger people, particularly girls. Pretty appalling on any level, but especially when you consider the audience despicable.
Yeah, that's what was so infuriating to, I'm sure, a lot of people, is just that outside of unborn babies, young girls are the weakest among the entire population on Earth. And so the terrorists are making it as obvious as possible that they want a full-blown war and that they really do hate human life in general. They just want to cause as much destruction and death and tragedy as possible.
It was a suicide bomber. He had a IED around his waist. Police say the male lone attacker is responsible. ISIS has claimed responsibility. That's probably not totally verified at this point. The man is 23 years old, Salman Abedi, who was known to British authorities prior to the attack. So they knew him. He was on a terror list. They did arrest somebody else as well. Not sure, you know, details are still coming out about that. But the man that did kill himself, 23-year-old Salman Abedi, and he was on these lists, terror watch lists, so they knew about him. He did not go into the concert venue. He waited outside, and when the people poured out, he detonated, and then there's a lot of people coming out, and that's a place where you could cause the most destruction, and he did.
Yeah, that really does present an interesting dilemma for a lot of arenas or stadiums or any place where there's going to be a large gathering of people. If you don't even have to pass through the security and the metal detectors to get in, you could just wait outside when people are exiting. Maybe security has to set up a wide perimeter around the building, just have a lot of checkpoints to even get that close to where all the people will be at one time. But really, that is, it does seem like a concern for, you know, anyone who gets into one of those big arenas. If there's anyone crazy enough to try something like that, even going to the Thunder games downtown, that's almost 20,000 people in one place. And so that would be a prime target for an attack.
And that's probably, you know, one of their big goals, create that sense of terror.
Right.
And that potential threat. And we live in an age of terrorism, and we probably have all had that similar thought, going to a venue where there's a lot of people, and you look around and think, if anything bad happened, this would be hard to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the U.S. says there's no credible threats at this point to concerts in the U.S. Take that for what it's worth. So it'll be interesting to see if this affects concert goers, if people think twice about going to some of these concerts. Hard to say. But then there was another sort of layer to this story, and that is a social media response. People jumped on social media, kind of on both sides of it, and there's some controversy there. I think you saw a few things about that.
Yeah, obviously there were probably a few people who were a bit opportunistic to try to maybe demonize a lot of people who have never even thought of committing terrorism. But a lot of the responses that stood out to me were really on the other extreme, where they were so worried about people being Islamophobic. That's just such a twisted view of reality. It's really just an upside down set of priorities to care more about how people react to the terrorist attack than they do about the people who died in that attack in the first place.
Katie Hopkins, she's a leading columnist for the Mail Online. She has been reported to police for calling for a, quote, final solution, the Nazi term for the Holocaust, after 22 people died at the terror attack. Hopkins swiftly changed the tweet to say real solution, but not before the tweet was screen grabbed and she was branded despicable. And so in her tweet, you know, she tweeted that there had been this attack, people had died, and she said we need a final solution. So she was reported to authorities for saying that, and so now she has to backtrack and say real solution. It's semantics at this point. I don't know if there's a difference between real solution, final solution. You can see the frustration. People do want terrorism to end. How do you end it? And that's the dilemma.
Yeah, and it would have to start with maybe caring a little bit more about the victims than caring about how people start talking after the attack is over. Obviously, people on both sides of the aisle could try to seize on these opportunities for political gain. But, I mean, just think about the victims. Those are the people who in the future we would like to see saved instead of being victimized again. Those same types of people in these same types of situations, what is a way to prevent attacks in the future? And a big part of it just has to be acknowledging who the enemy is. We seem incapable of even doing that.
Right. You can't win a battle if you can't identify an enemy. I think the youngest that I saw was 8. I think we mentioned that. And then one of the girls is considered a super fan of this singer, Ariana Grande. And I was able to meet her, I believe, the night before, whether it was through a contest or something, I'm not sure. But big day for her. She gets to meet the singer she's really likes. So excited about it. There's a picture of them together. And the next day, she's killed at the concert. A crazy turn of events in one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that made me wonder, you know, what that type of attack would like, what kind of effect that type of attack would have on people who were there. You know, someone like Ariana Grande, I don't really know much about her personal beliefs, but it would probably be true that she's a liberal. And what kind of effect would this have on her thinking when she's probably been told for a long time that terrorism is not even a threat in the U.S. We've been hearing that a lot. And a lot of people in Britain are extremely liberal as well. But the fact is, there are threats like this that have to be dealt with.
Yeah, the artists have to be concerned, too. I mean, there's been 2 terror attacks, I guess, over in Europe now that have been concert venues, at least that right. I can think of. So, really shocking. There's a headline here, too, saying there's 3,500 suspected terrorists in the UK right now. What do you do? It's tough for the authorities. They go around. I mean, you go round them up. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't do that. There'd be an outcry. But there's 3,500 of them, and it just takes one person to cause carnage. It's a very difficult situation, and it'd be tough to be a politician right now because people want answers, and it's hard to have answers without stepping on somebody's toes.
Yeah, it's hard to deal with a problem without being labeled as an extremist as well. I mean, when you have 3,500 terror threats in one country, you know who all those people are. They're on a list. But simply being on a list is not going to prevent someone from walking around and possibly doing some damage. Detaining them would prevent them, except for the fact that a lot of people would be very upset by that.
It's not an easy situation, but there's just more and more of these. Bloomberg has a report about just a list of all the terror attacks that have occurred in Europe. And we don't have enough time to read them all, I don't think. It's been a lot. You know, of course, most recently, the man driving the hijacked beer truck. That was in April and March. A man drives a rented SUV into pedestrians. On the 19th, December 19th, hijacked truck plows into a Christmas market in Berlin. They're talking about all of Europe, of course. A lot of them have been truck attacks, other attacks, and just one after the other. But it is interesting because there have been so many. It used to be that it would be a top story for days and weeks and even sometimes a little more than that. And I bet by the end of the day, or next couple of days, it'll already be down to the, you know, other news because it's just so commonplace now. So pretty interesting situation there. I'm sure a lot more will be talked about there on the Trumpet Daily tomorrow from Ed Stone, England. And so make sure you listen for that at 7 a.m. to hear those comments and those updates as well. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau stopping by. And so quite a day yesterday in that way. We were mentioning the terror attack there, Abraham. And I told Grant I heard about it when I was at a graduation get-together. So it's always interesting because you're going about normal life and happy things, and then you hear about these really horrific stories.
Yeah, I was helping my wife make dinner, and then we watched Kelly's Heroes, Clint Eastwood movie, last night. And just checking the news and first saw it that way. And it is always sobering to see that, especially when the UK is in the midst of a pretty big election.
And I think they've suspended campaigns, at least for a little bit, just out of respect, obviously, for the attack or the victims.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's amazing how with terrorism, it's perfectly designed to strangle democracies because they can use our laws against us. And you have to take away certain freedoms in order to be effective in fighting it. But you don't want to take away those freedoms. So it's a tough job for any politician. I definitely don't envy any of them right now. But hopefully, at least in the UK, they can start making some progress there.
Yeah, it's a really tough situation. Of course, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago that this WannaCry computer virus attacked, and those perpetrators were trying to hold data for ransom. The hardest hit by that WannaCry infection was the U.S. had 17,000 people affected, Russia 50,000, Ukraine 11,000, China 74,000, and Taiwan 19,000. And the rest of the world didn't have any major issues with that. So poor Ukraine, right? You look at the population of those other nations and their large population centers. And then Ukraine, for some reason, with 11,000. Ukraine can't win. They're having a hard go of it. Disney was hit with that. Disney's CEO said hackers threatened to release one of the studio's movies early unless it paid a ransom in Bitcoin, which Bitcoins are worth $2,000 a piece, by the way. So get them while you can. Media reports claim the film is the latest Pirates of the Caribbean sequel. Disney said they're not paying. We're not going to pay you.
Well, I don't think anyone would be too disappointed if it was released early. And based off of reviews, I'm not sure. Well, I'm sure there will be disappointment all the way around. But I'm just kidding. But I did see another article where internationally, the people behind the virus, they only made about $100,000 despite all the people they hacked, which is still a large amount of money, but for all the fuss about it, they actually didn't make that much on it as maybe they feared initially.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on who you hacked. If they have their data backed up, maybe they don't care. If you're just if you're not a big company, maybe it's just your personal stuff and you're like, I don't care. it's not that relevant. Because really, a lot of the information on the internet is not relevant. If you pared down the information out there to just relevant information, that would knock out about, 95% of the internet?
Right.
There's a lot of stuff out there, but it's not always valuable. In a lot of cases, it's not. So anyway, that's kind of an interesting look at who was hit by the WannaCry. I do kind of like the name, though. It's funny to me. WannaCry?
Yeah, I wonder how
is
they
it a
came
taunt?
Up with that.
Yeah. You want to cry over this? Like, I don't know how they meant it. Like, how are they taunting with that? I wonder who comes up with those things. I've got this great idea to hack, you know, and what do you guys want to call it? You got to call it something.
Well, it seems to be a committee of people who just decide to name everything. like they name more conflicts, but different scandals. They name everything in the media. They just find a name for it that's catchy. And I guess, it just seems like most things do catch on pretty well.
You got to have a catchy name.
That just shows you have a lot of power too, doesn't it? If you can name anything in life besides your own kids or dogs, you know, that just kind of shows you have some influence.
Yeah, the ability to name things. The Key David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Jeremiah Jacques taking it today, filling in for your normal host, Stephen Fleury, who should be back tomorrow, I believe. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com top story today. France saved from the abyss? ? What Emmanuel Macron's victory means for France and for Europe. Related to that, how Europe is winning, quote-unquote, against the far right. Those are the top stories at thetrumpet.com today. Another note, Roger Moore, dead at 89. You might remember him, James Bond star. He died after a short cancer battle. So he had a pretty good long life, one of the famous 007s, a Hollywood icon, I guess, dead at 89.
Yeah, he was famous for his one-liners he would have. So it is sad to see that happen, but he did live a long life, and that's... that is good considering a lot of actors and musicians that we've heard about recently have died prematurely.
Yeah, 89. So there's been, I guess whenever you're coming up with a movie plot, it's good that you can replace people and just bring out another one because no actor lasts forever. That's why those cartoons stick around for so long because they never age. The Simpsons?
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
If you look at some of them, the drawing, you can tell it was a different artist early on because they don't look quite the same. Like, somebody else drew that guy. But yeah, I always think that's funny. You know, they don't age. They're just cartoon characters. So humans, and you never have to renegotiate with the cartoons. You know, they don't want more money or leave to go do a movie. So whoever thought that the cartoons was a good idea was probably right. You don't have to deal with the human element other than artists, but you can get a lot of those.
Yeah, it must really be a time of great uncertainty for movie producers and directors when one actor gets too old and they have to replace that actor. And it's a lot of times if it's a star of that successful movie franchise, they must be wondering if it'll be just as popular with the next guy who steps into that role.
Oh, it's extremely hard, especially for ladies in Hollywood, because once you start aging, you know, they do all they can to try to not look like they're getting older. But the reality is, as they say, especially in sports, one opponent is never defeated, and that's Father Time.
Yes.
Doesn't matter how good you are, you're going to get older, and eventually you get old. And when your livelihood is based on, you know, your physical appearance or whatever, that's a diminishing ability. So, yeah, I do feel for those people in some ways because they're fighting a battle they can't win trying to stay young.
Yeah, it is interesting. Just one thing I do in my hobby is I analyze movies to see how historically accurate they are. And then I...
And seriously, you do that?
Yes.
Okay.
And I tell my wife, and then she doesn't really pay attention to me, but that's okay. Because it's just stuff like, what are you even talking about? But anyway... One thing that's really interesting is, just since we're on the subject, is that with these movies, they always try, they make any character, no matter who they were, the young, try to make them young, attractive, strong-willed. That's basically, no matter who they were historically, that's who they try to fit that person, because that's what this generation wants to watch. And that's what the latest series on Victoria from Great Britain, she doesn't look anything like Queen Victoria. She's, no offense to Queen Victoria, I do love Queen Victoria, but she's too pretty to be Queen Victoria. And she's too strong-willed. She's too independent. They're trying to put a 20-year-old from the 21st century into the 1800s, right. And it doesn't work. So, and the reason I bring it up is just so with these actresses and actors, you have to fit a certain part or people aren't going to watch you anymore. Because it's kind of universal now. You need to be a certain way in order for people to find you entertaining.
Yeah, that's true. Whenever they do make a movie about somebody that actually existed, they always do look better in the movie. You never see it where the real person looked better than the actor.
Yeah.
who would you want to play you? Abraham Blondeau's great historical movie.
Probably Daniel Craig. But.
Daniel Craig.
Yeah. I think there's a resemblance.
Grant, you wanted Denzel Washington, right?
For yes, yes.
Okay.
I think it's a dead ringer there.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to see what people would think. You know, you'd think, come on now. I look different than this guy. But, yeah, that's always interesting with the entertainment. So Roger Moore, they're dead at 89. One other note, this guy in Southern California, a lot of people like fishing and hunting, and this guy in Southern California, fisherman, he catches a rare giant fish. Sean Stewart of Oxnard, California, had a once-in-a-lifetime catch last week in the Channel Islands. He caught a 90-pound opa, which is a very rare fish to that area. It's a unique and brightly colored fish usually caught further south. I don't know if people would know what that fish is. I didn't know. But it looks like a goldfish, sort of. A little different, but kind of like a fish you'd have swimming in a little tank, except it was bigger than him. he's holding it, and it's the same size as him, the man. And I thought, wow, but it looks so friendly and so cute, but it's just huge. So pulling that thing out of the water would be frightening and exhilarating, I think.
Yeah, someone must have flushed their goldfish when they were young, and it ended up in that lake and had some kind of mutative powers to it, because it's, yeah, that's... It's always weird when you see a small animal, or an animal you're used to seeing small, but it's on a huge scale. It's just kind of unsettling, because you're like, well, how many more of these are there out there?
Yeah, this thing, this opa fish, it's not like long and slim or slender. It's round. I mean, it looks like, the whole thing looks like the head almost. Anyway, the picture is on Fox News. Wow. Check it out. It's just a, again, it looks like the fish you'd see floating around in a little bowl. It's just huge. So anyway, I'm just kind of sad he caught it. I mean, I'm glad he caught it and take the picture, but don't put him back.
Yeah.
He's a national treasure. He killed it.
That makes me think of, you know, how catfish are normally like a foot or two long, but I was watching that show, River Monsters, I think, on Discovery Channel, and they were catching this thing called a goonch, which is like an 8 or 12 foot long catfish that eats human beings.
What?
So normally you wouldn't think of a catfish as being on that large of a scale, but apparently they're out there.
Wow. Do they catch them? They don't catch them the same way where you stick your arm in the hole, do
No.
they? Oh, yeah.
But for some reason, this guy's able to use a regular fishing line and bring in these massive fish, and the line is so strong it still doesn't even break.
I'd love to see like what really goes on those shows. They probably send in a whole crew to like go down there and you know, catch the fish first, and then, you know, you throw the line in, oh, I got a bite, and they pull the thing out. It's like Vladimir Putin fishing in Russia, always catching sharks.
I did notice that the entire struggle of catching the fish is greatly condensed.
Yeah.
I don't know if they just didn't want to waste 30 minutes showing him try to reel in one big fish, but it's always like 10 seconds later he's able to pull it in after hooking it on the line there.
I've never seen that show. It sounds interesting, though.
My brother loves that show, and so I was watching it while I was over at the house with him a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
But it's really exciting.
Yeah, they have a whole like genre of those shows where they're finding gold in that one show, and then I guess they're finding giant fish, and then they had that fishing one up off Alaska, Deadliest Catch, I think it was. So they have all those nature meets reality. Oh, and then there's when there's a family living in Alaska in a log cabin or something.
I think so.
Yeah. Dude doing something, trying to, I don't know, all kinds of stuff going on out there. President Trump is overseas on his first overseas trip. And he's going to be going to Vatican City next. Pope Francis is going to welcome President Trump to the Vatican on May 24th and has said he will try to find common ground with the president. That'll be interesting. Trump is then expected to reaffirm his commitment to NATO, which that'll be interesting too, at a summit in Brussels before flying to a G7 meeting in Italy with world leaders, including France's Emmanuel Macron. So a lot going on over there right now, though. He is still over in that in the Israel area, I guess. And Grant, you've got a write-up here from The Federalist. They say Trump is overestimating Palestinians' desire for peace. Without knowing all the details of the write-up, I would say that is probably true.
Yeah, I would say so, too. He was recently at a meeting with, I believe it was Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas, and he, Mr. Trump, that is, and he did say that he thought it would be easier than some people would think to make peace in the region. So it seems like in this case, maybe he doesn't understand exactly how extreme one side is and how difficult it has been for the last several decades to even forge any peace at all.
Every president that has come in, obviously, in recent times, that's one of their big to-dos. Peace in the Middle East, it would be the major feather in the cap, I guess. But yet, it just gets more and more violent over there. And, you know, President Trump seems like he does believe you can make a deal with almost anybody. Like, everybody's got their price sort of thing. The Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase used to say that, the professional wrestler. Everybody's got their price. 80s flashback, sorry. But at the same time, you're dealing with a different thing. You're not dealing with business here and money in that sense. I mean, you're dealing with very different ideologies, and one ideology wants to destroy the other race, which are the Palestinians and Iran. They want to destroy Israel. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of those groups like the Palestinians or Iran would be fine with taking money in a deal, obviously, but they also happen to be a death cult, so that's where any sort of hope for negotiation would end. There's not really much of a chance of negotiating with people who are inflexible in their desire to push Israel into the Mediterranean Sea.
Well, and I mean, the Palestinians have been trying to, or Abbas, he has been trying to come across as more moderate with President Trump. And something, you know, we talked about that, I guess it was last week, where, you know, he said that they teach their children to have peace or something like that. Words sound good, but completely different than their actions.
Yeah, and it is true that Mr. Trump does have an admirable vision here of peace. He does seem like he is kind of thinking about something like the millennium, where he's just really hoping for world peace and willing to do anything that he can to achieve that. But, of course, human beings, as we are, cannot achieve anything of the sort. He actually even went on a direct flight from Saudi Arabia straight to Tel Aviv, which is extremely rare just because Saudi Arabia and Israel do not have any sort of diplomatic ties. And I don't think it's even possible to have a direct flight there unless maybe you're on your own plane like he was.
He's doing things that are symbolic in that
right way,
and trying to kind of, you know, be the first to do some of these things and hoping that maybe there will be some peace there. There was a great quote. I can't remember it exactly, but I think it was from Prime Minister Netanyahu, where he said, if you were to disarm the Palestinians, or if the Palestinians put down their arms, there'd be peace today. And if Israel put down their arms, they wouldn't exist. Something to that effect. I think that was Netanyahu that said that. And that's true. I mean, if you want to sum it up, this whole situation between Israel and the Palestinians, I think that does sum it up.
Right. That is, that's the reality of the situation, even though a lot of people are just not willing to acknowledge that reality. Most nations in the world refuse to acknowledge that. It seems like Mr. Trump realizes that Israel is the good guy side, if you could pick a good guy side. So at least he realizes that, but he also greatly overestimates the ability of the Palestinian side to desire peace. So in Mr. Trump's deal-making mindset, it seems like what he's looking to do is offer Israel some alliances with these Sunni states to basically partner against Iran, the Shiite radical power of Iran. But the only way Mr. Trump will offer those sorts of alliances or try to broker alliances with those Sunni nations is if Israel makes some concessions in peace with the Palestinians. So that's kind of his bargaining chip there. But while Israel, I'm sure, would be fine with negotiating with the Sunni states or allying with them against Iran, since Iran is really the ultimate threat in that region, reality says that there's not much more they can really even do to make peace with the Palestinians. They've pretty much offered everything short of national suicide to appease the Palestinians, and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, it seems like these different terrorist groups, they're happy to negotiate because they'll take what they can get for free with this, you know, idea of peace out there, and then just keep going about their terrorist ways. That's been the history over there.
Yeah, well, I think the only way that President Trump's going to find out, and he kind of hinted at in his speech in Riyadh, just where he singled out Hamas and other terrorist groups as a source of the problem. In the world of terrorism, he mentioned Hamas, which is the group there in the Gaza Strip. So And Hamas gets funding from different places, including Iran. So I think, as with any other U.S. president, the only way to stop the Palestinians from having weapons is to first cut off the head of the snake in Iran. And then when Hamas is neutralized, then you can negotiate, perhaps. Because as long as there are weapons in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they'll fight. They won't negotiate. They won't surrender. But if you're able to cut off the funding, cut off the weapons, and then neutralize Hamas, then there might be the possibility of some kind of weakening on the Palestinian side, because they know they're going to lose at that point. So to me, that's the only possible way it can happen, and it has to happen first on a, not through negotiations, but action against Iran. Has either military or some kind of just very, very harsh political sanctions or something like that. But to me, I think President Trump, that's what he's going to find out. And he kind of hinted at that he's going to be very hard in Iran. But I'm not sure if he's put the two together.
Well, you know, I'm glad that the Federalist is talking about it, because it is worth talking about. But it highlights something with the media, too. They're so caught up in just trying to get the current president out of there and doing whatever they can to do that, and not even really apologizing for it. That the actual stories that they should be talking about, including some policy and some of these things, you don't see enough stories about that. At least I haven't seen enough stories about that.
Exactly. This is an area where legitimately they could point out that Mr. Trump just doesn't realize how difficult it's going to be to try to broker peace in this region. Bill Clinton tried it in the 1990s. President George W. Bush tried it. Barack Obama tried it. But they really, those last two, largely backed off just because of how much Bill Clinton failed in that area. So they kind of started to realize that this is something maybe to mostly avoid, just because it doesn't seem like there even is a solution. If I try to put a whole lot of effort into it, it's just going to be a highly publicized failure for me.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a change to have a president come in and say, yeah, it's hopeless. We're going to do something else. People be like, oh, huh, interesting.
Well, what's interesting, too, about what Donald Trump has done, at least from what I can see, is that most presidents, like President Obama and President Bush, when they come to power, they make this big speech saying, these are my goals, this is how we're going to do it, and that's the vision. President Trump, he's been very vague. He said, well, I want to make the deal of deals, broker peace in the Middle East, but he hasn't said anything. He doesn't say anything about a two-state solution, one-state solution. He's talked with both sides, but he hasn't come up publicly and said how he wants to do it necessarily in a very like clear-cut manner as other presidents have done. I just think that's interesting, because maybe he's just gauging everything and then he'll make a decision later, which is probably a little bit smarter than making this big proclamation and having everyone undercut you. So it is interesting that he's taken that approach, and maybe after the trip he'll have some big speech where he might have a game plan on how he's going to do it.
Yeah, it seems like that's if that's what he's doing, it's smarter, because you can't make much of a deal if you're telling everybody what you're hoping to happen. Even in the world of sports, they'll ask the coach, you know, like, what's your game plan? And they're always very vague, because they're not going to tell you their game plan. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to try to do is, you know, because they want to keep it secret. That's the point. And then see how it works and make some changes there. So I think in almost any area of life, if somebody's trying to make some sort of a deal or work something out, then they really wouldn't talk about it too openly until the deal's done, or they know more where they're going.
Well, that does show Mr. Trump's expertise in this deal-making area. He hasn't kind of put all his cards on the table and shown both sides exactly what's going on. So it really does give him a better chance of having success, or at least not being pilloried for failing, because he never explicitly stated what he was trying to do. So if they criticize him for supposedly failing, he could say, well, I never even said what the objective was, so you don't even know if I failed or not.
And just blame Russia if it doesn't work. That's from the Federalist. Trump is overestimating Palestinians' desire for peace, and he continues on that trip for another day or so, and then he's over to Europe. Abraham, interesting write-up here from Quartz. Instagram is the most harmful social network for your mental health.
Well, this makes me feel good. I'm not on Instagram. But many are.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've talked about social media a lot and the false image it can give off, or that's basically why it exists in some ways. This article here, it brings together a few different studies showing after they asked a group of individuals how they used it and if it was affecting their health. And it's just interesting to go over. And it is a legitimate problem in our first world society. And so the research, they took about 1,500 young people in the UK, and they asked them, well, how does social media affect your health? And they found that the social media contributes to mental health problems such as anxiety, depression, sleep deprivation, and body image issues in young people. And young people are the heaviest users of it. For example, Instagram has 700 million users globally.
Wow.
And I think, I forget how many Facebook has, but it's massive.
Yeah.
I think it's up close near a billion people, I believe.
And they want you. They want you on their networks, obviously. I think I have a Facebook account, but I never do anything with it. But I get emails once in a while like, you got a lot of friends on Facebook? I'm like, no, I don't. Why are you trying to seduce me?
Yeah. Well, even too, I was trying to watch a forum last night on war reporting or like a discussion, and you had to be on Facebook to watch it because you have to be a member to use Facebook Live and stuff. So I was a little annoyed about that because I don't want to get Facebook and I'm not going to get just to watch a streaming event. But that's how they try to hook you in with it.
And people find you quick. I mean, you know, if you go on Facebook and you sign up, all of a sudden it's like people you haven't talked to in 15 years.
Yeah.
Hey! And you're like, whoa. Sometimes that's fine, but sometimes you're like, eh.
That's like the real life equivalent of someone hiding in the bushes and then popping out as you walk past.
Yeah.
Like if you just had no idea where they were in cyberspace and yet somehow they come out of nowhere just to say hi after 20 years away.
Yeah, they will find you. And then they'll put a photo up on Instagram.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the way the past catches up with people, I guess. This was a UK survey from the Royal Society of Public Health, and they asked the people between the ages of 14 and 24, about 1,500 people, and it covered the social networks of Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, YouTube, and Twitter. And all of them, except for YouTube, thought it had a negative effect. YouTube was the only one with a positive effect.
It's because of all the cat videos.
Yes, exactly.
Makes you feel good.
Yeah. This is in order from least negative to most. They are, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram.
Yeah.
So Twitter's of all the platforms, because YouTube's social networking, but it's more of just a video platform. But Instagram's the worst, and Twitter is the best of people having a positive outcome from it. And the biggest one was Instagram having a negative effect on body image.
Yeah.
And that seems like that was the biggest problem. And it's interesting, the courts here, these people, they went through some pictures and they just took a picture of themselves and then they were able to alter it and make it look like a model. And it wasn't as professional as the other ones, but with the apps nowadays, you can manipulate pictures so easily to where it creates an unrealistic picture. And then you have these young girls growing up thinking that's how they can become happy, that's how they become rich or have the lifestyle these people do. And it just creates a whole lot of problems when any teenager already has lots of issues with being self-conscious or trying to figure out who they are in the world.
Yeah, I've thought about that. Being a teen, I mean, there's certain challenges that come with that. But back in my day, in the 90s, even if there was let's say there was a situation that you didn't like at school, you know, maybe you a certain group of people and, you know, you have a thing with them, you can get away. You could go home and, you know, especially like over the summer, you're like, I won't see them until next year or whatever. You can't get away anymore because if you're on the internet, which you pretty much have to be, and you have to be on the social media platforms, unless you're, I guess, just completely not involved. Not that would be bad not to be, but I think people feel a pressure to be involved in it. And you can't get away from people. they'll put up a message about you, or they'll, you know, critique what you're doing. And it's 24/7. You can't get away from that pressure, and I think that's pretty daunting.
Yeah, and speaking of problems with body image on Instagram, there has been that category of maybe like a career or a profession called YouTube celebrities, but likewise on Instagram, there's Instagram models who their whole livelihood seems to be trying to make their pictures look pretty on Instagram, and they actually make a lot of money off that. And like Abraham said, a lot of those pictures are unrealistic. They're filtered 1,000 times to make it look like the person's basically descended from the gods.
Yeah, and most cases when you're growing up, at least they used to say this, and I would think they still do, but adults, parents, and so forth, they'll tell you, look, who you are as a person is more important than the way you look. It's not all about the way you look. The, you know, can't judge a book by its cover, et cetera, et cetera. But in something like Instagram, that's all it is. It's the cover of the book. And that's what the value is placed on your appearance. And so, and we've all been there to where, even if you're just looking at a photo somebody took of you, where it's like a weird angle, or you're like, "Ooh, I don't like that." But you can usually move on. But on a platform designed to be nothing but image, well, that's what it is. Superficial image has nothing to do with the person. It's just the way they look, and it is very destructive.
Yeah, and I think this is a good indication of how shallow our society is, that despite we'll hear lots of campaigns on, oh, it doesn't matter what a woman looks like, it's her personality, or same thing with men, or just trying to get back away from this image-obsessed generation we have, basically. But it's the social media platforms that are driving it, and you can't really stop them. And especially when there's millions of dollars involved as well, it's there, people aren't going to sacrifice that. And so it's just interesting. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of cyberbullying on it, and even lack of sleep. The Journal of Youth Studies found that 1 in 5 young people wake up during the night to check messages.
Wow.
So 20% of young people from this survey, they lose sleep just from wanting to check out what their friends thought about their picture or whatever it might be. And so it's affecting young people's lives. And as you mentioned, even growing up, I didn't have internet until I was in high school. And so all I had was books and movies. Like, that's how, and what I saw with my own eyes. Those were the only ways I could take in the world around me. And so I'm thankful for that, because I base who I wanted to be on books or if I saw a movie or something I liked. It affects us in more ways than one. But young people, they're not reading anymore. They're more interested in social media. And they did find that 70% of respondents, that they did find emotional support from social media, like a good story, or they talk with someone, like their friend, over it. So there is that. There can be a positive side to it. But I think the big issue with it, if we look at the broad scope, is that these social media platforms are creating a culture that is only getting worse. And it's a culture where if people are making money from it, and if we have a young generation emulating it, it's only going to get worse. Because if the young people take on to it now, the next generation is going to just go into more extremes trying to find that image, I guess.
Well, and people are going to regret what they put up there. If you're putting up pictures and so forth, some of them probably aren't going to be the best. And then, you know, 20 years down the road, assuming it's still all floating around out there somewhere, that can come back and get you. That does happen. You see where people go and they'll apply for a job. They're going to check your social media.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're not going to get that job.
Yeah, and also that focus on appearance, which, you know, to in a certain balance, appearance does matter. Presenting yourself the right way,
having you're extremely proper... handsome. That's why you're
exactly.
Working here.
That's why I'm on radio where you can't see me.
Right.
But it's not as important as the ideas in a person's head. And when you focus all on what someone looks like, the premium of ideas really does go down. And you see that in society now. Look at some of the radical ideas that are out there. The more shallow we've gotten in these different areas of life, then we have all these different ideas out there that are radical and destructive to the entire country.
Well, the teen culture sort of rules pop culture, obviously, and it has for some time, and now it's just taken to social media. But the thing for the people that are, and I guess it would be particularly the ladies that are very heavily into Instagram, and that's kind of where they make their name for themselves or aspire to be there. Again, like just talked about, like the Hollywood stars, well, that doesn't last. What's the goal? Like, what's the end goal of life? That would be the question. Is it, if it is to be an Instagram superstar, you're past your prime at what, 25,
yeah.
26? With Photoshop, maybe 29? whatever it is. You're past your prime. You're not a kid anymore. You're not young. And then what? You got the rest of your life to sit there and be miserable? And I mean, what's the point of life? That's the question.
Yeah, ideally you'd think that we would all want to, you know, obviously there's going to be some valleys, but if we're just kind of ascending our whole lives and then reaching the peak at the end instead of peaking at our 20s and then it's all downhill from there, that's really not something to aspire to. And probably people who are super into Instagram are probably not thinking much past the moment because the reality is not too pleasant there.
Yeah. If you want to make an app that'll fail immediately, they should call it Bookagram, where you take a picture of your favorite book and then write what you liked about it. No followers, no users.
Who reads books?
Made no money. Yeah, well, there'd probably be a niche group out there, but really interesting. That's from Quartz. Instagram is the most harmful social network for your mental health. Some good points to look at. One other note you had for us, Abraham, you want to talk a little bit about Winston Churchill and his historical imagination that was mentioned on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on Monday, and that was they played back Mr. Gerald Fleury's commencement address to the students at Herbert W. Armstrong College, where we're broadcasting from, and he talked about Churchill and having a historical imagination, and you want to look at where Churchill got it, how he got that historical imagination, and what is it? That's an interesting phrase. We don't hear that often.
Yeah. It's if the listeners haven't listened to that Trumpet Daily on Monday, it's the last 30 minutes or so on the Trumpet Daily, I believe. I encourage them to go listen to it, and because it's just a great, fascinating message and very stirring. And the phrase historical imagination, it comes from a series of essays, Isaiah Berlin. He was a philosopher and a writer and a speaker. He wrote about Winston Churchill and what he did in Great Britain. The phrase he used is historical imagination. And he, as Mr. Fleury points out, it's all about how that historical imagination inspired the British people. And basically what he means by that is that Churchill had a way of looking at the present and then looking to the past and finding examples where people succeeded and drawing on those examples to inspire people in their current plight, especially during the dark days of World War II when Britain was standing alone. It was Churchill's resolve, his spirit, his courage, all emanated from what he understood about history and trying to follow the examples of people in the past in British history. And that's that same spirit he gave to the British people. It wasn't something Churchill invented. It was something that had been there for a long time, but Churchill resurrected it in that moment because of looking to the past and seeing what other people have done. And so that's what he's talking about, having this ability to be so, have a good fund of knowledge, but also being able to apply it and inspire other people to act on it.
Yeah, to look at what has happened in the past and get a vision of what you could do in the present and in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
So where did Churchill get this historical imagination?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it can be boiled down to a few different factors. One is how the circumstances in which he was born. He was an aristocrat. His father was a very prominent politician, and so Churchill's life revolved around British politics. He was born in Blenheim Palace, where it was given to the Duke of Marlborough for winning the Battle of Blenheim during the War of Spanish Succession. So Churchill was born into circumstances that kind of cultivated that interest because he came from a famous family in Great Britain. So that has something to do with it. But I think the bigger part of it is just his upbringing. And I think it's really interesting. Any person who needs inspiration as a young person can read about his life. and realized that he, people who knew him when he was young didn't expect him to become anything. His father told him he wouldn't amount to anything, that he would live out to be a failure. And his father died when he was 19, 20 years old. So his father didn't even see him achieve all his big achievements. But how Churchill got through that is, as a young, well, as a young man, he wasn't good at Latin and the other subjects, but he was good at history and English. And these kinds of things attracted him to reading Shakespeare and being interested in what his father's friends, who were the huge statesmen at the time, talking to them and learning more about British history. But I think the key moment was when he decided to go into the army. And that's when he became part of something bigger and expanded his imagination. And he always had a good ambition. But when you read about Churchill, you have to understand he was a politician, a historian, a writer. But first and foremost, he was a warrior. And that's what kind of shaped his life. And he learned about history so he can defend the British Empire and make it better. And that's he used history as a means to making the world around him better. And so he had this world view of that way. And the big way he cultivated it was when he was in India as a young subaltern in the 8th Hussars. His mother sent him a bunch of books, Gibbon, Macaulay, Plato. He read all the big classics. And that's when he started to write, and that's when how he kind of shaped this image of British history that would help him throughout his whole life.
Well, you know, it's really valuable if you think about it now for us in this time. Okay, we talked about two stories today, primarily. Terror attacks in Britain, UK, and Europe, and trying to have peace in the Middle East, right? So if you start like you were just born today and you're just looking at it, that's, I think, kind of where people are. Like, well, we have to forget about everything in the past and just move forward and figure out some new solution. And we just keep kind of going through that journey, but it never works. You know, what about stopping and saying, okay, let's look at the history of terrorism, not just recently, but far back as we can go, and let's see how people dealt with it and whether it worked or not. And then let's take a look at trying to have a resolution between two people, two groups of people, like you see in the Middle East. And let's look at the history of it. The history, has it worked? How would we do it? What's worked in the past? What hasn't? And then go from there. But it doesn't seem like that happens very often. It's just like, again, like people were born today and we have no idea about anything in the past and we're just going to invent it as we go.
Yeah, and in that commencement address on Sunday, Mr. Flory said that college students, especially because they can go through an entire 4 years at the university without even taking a single history course, are actually lost in the present. They don't really have any sort of context for the world that they're living in today. They know about right now, and a lot of that's intentional. History teachers who think that teaching national history is an elitist irrelevance, as he also brought out, that's really just a dangerous way of looking at things. Mr. Churchill was able to make extremely unpopular decisions because he knew the whole framework of the situation. He knew the entire history of that circumstance going back hundreds of years in some cases. And so even when the liberal newspapers were trashing him for certain things, he was able to make the unpopular decision that was later recorded in history as being correct.
And you can have a lot of confidence as a leader in making those decisions if you're basing it on what's happened in the past. Otherwise, what can you have confidence in? Your own take on things? That's not good for anything, usually. But if you look back and you see what worked and what didn't, at least you have a foundation for your present decision.
Yeah, and that's a big importance. A young American college student asked Churchill in the 1950s, well, what should I read? What should I study? And Churchill said history, because in history lie all the secrets of statecraft. And what he's talking about, if you want to be a good leader and know what to do for your nation, you have to read history. Because it is the thoughts, it's the actions of people running nations and of all the individuals in them. And so that's how we learn to make the right decisions. And so with Churchill and John Lukacs, he's another historian, he said Churchill had a historical philosophy. I think that's associated with this historical imagination, where Churchill used the past and he created a way in which he would learn from it. It would change his life. He just didn't read it for head knowledge. It was a part of how he lived every day. And I think that's important for us to do in a way, is how we judge our actions against something that is tried and tested. It's not, we don't judge ourselves by our emotions, how it makes us feel in the moment. We judge our actions based off of how will they affect this generation for 40 years? How will it affect my children and for in their lives? All these different things have big ramifications. And so it's Churchill's historical imagination, I think, started when he was a young man. And it started out of a young life that he had lots of hardships. He didn't have many friends. His parents weren't very good. And so he had to latch on to something to give him inspiration, to give him motivation, and that was history. I think that's something that all of us can learn from and find some inspiration from ourselves.
Yeah, and use it. It's a valuable tool. That's all the time we have for today on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of Day program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming your way here in just a bit. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo, thanks for spending some time with us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.